Hello there, this is VK3OTN, the official station of the Radio Amateur Alzheimer's Club of Australia, with the monthly news broadcast for members and friends of the club for November 2023. This month, instead of the usual broadcast, we will offer an historical broadcast from years past. The usual news and information will be broadcast next month. I'm Andrew, VK3 Charlie Alpha Hotel. I have broadcast files going back as far as 2001. Many of the older files aren't the greatest as far as technical quality goes, archived in either Real Audio or Windows Media Audio format. These produced a smaller file size back in the days when the leading edge technology was dial-up internet. Remember that? This month we have an original broadcast from February 2002. Details on when to hear these news and information broadcasts are available at the club website, www.raotc.org.au. The VK3OTN is available on a wide range of radio platforms, HF, VHF and UHF, 2-metre repeaters, amateur television, DMR, that is digital mobile radio, and D-Star. These news broadcasts are available for download for up to 6 months, just in case you miss the original news broadcast from the RAOTC website. If you'd like to contact the club, then why not send us an email, raotc@raotc.org.au. I hope you enjoy this month's broadcast.
Alan Dove on VK3AMD and Associated Relay Stations is VK3OTN, the official call sign for Radio Amateur Alzheimer's Club. Well, it's good to be back on the air with this broadcast, the first for the year 2002, as hard as that is to believe. We hope all of you listening today have a happy Christmas season, that you and your families will have a healthy and happy year, and a successful time in our great hobby of amateur radio. Having said all that, you'll naturally want to know what's happening about incorporation, which the majority of members voted for. At a long committee meeting on Tuesday, January the 15th, Arthur Evans, VK3VQ, our secretary, presented us with all the documentation involved, and there is a lot of that, starting with the appropriate Act of Parliament, plus the rules applying under the Act, and the long and involved preferred rules for an incorporated body. We believe that we could and should make some changes in details of parts of these sample rules to better suit our own circumstances. Bill Roper, VK3BR, has composed a sample of the rules, including the suggested detailed changes, and your committee will meet again very soon for further discussion. This is a process that cannot be hurried because of its far-reaching consequences, but rest assured we'll keep on working at it. This is VK3OTN. Now, about our transmissions in VK6 last December, it was an historic first for the club. Early last year, our VK6 friends were able to arrange for the 20-metre transmission from Melbourne to be fed to the WIA VK6 repeater network by Clive VK6SW for the benefit of those who could not get a good signal direct from Melbourne, for one reason or another. Later in the year, Clem VK6CSW, VK6OTN, suggested that we explore the possibility of feeding the broadcast down the line on the internet so that a high-quality tape sent this way shortly after the original broadcast in Melbourne could then be put to air through the repeater network by Tony VK6TS at the same time as the 20-metre transmission was being beamed direct. After many hours on the internet between Clem VK6CSW and Bill VK3BR, a very high-grade transmission was sent via the internet using the Real Audio format. Feedback after the broadcast last time was very positive and very enthusiastic, with 14 repeater listeners reporting back to Tony VK6TS. While all this was going on, Clive, VK6CSW, was standing by to do the transfer from 20 metres to the repeater net if the new internet venture didn't work out. Well, it did work out, in spades, and we all owe our thanks and gratitude to the operators I have named. This month, the same procedure will be followed, and Clive plans to put the program, at least Clem, VK6CS7, he plans to put the program on 40 meters. 7075 is the planned frequency. That's great. I'm sorry to report the passing from us of Leith Cotton, VK5LG, who was member number 186, and Leith was 96 years old. Also, Ken Horan, VK5IT, who was member number 592. I think I've got a right reading my own writing, not 597. Sorry about that. Clive Castle, who was member number 145. And Roth Jones, who held the call sign VK3BG for many years, and was member number 17. Let's pause for just a few moments in memory of these long-time friends. This is VK3OTN. About our magazine, our editor Stuart Day, VK3ESD, is working on the forthcoming March issue of our popular magazine, OTN. Both Stuart as magazine editor and myself as your broadcast presenter are finding it harder than it used to be to find suitable material. We do need more input from our members because it is reminiscences and or experiences of our members that both our broadcast and our magazine are meant to be about. Don't be shy. Your experiences are interesting to your fellow members, and don't worry about bad handwriting. It cannot be worse than my own, which I have just been reading to you. Enough said. Here in Melbourne, we'll be having lunch at our usual venue, the Bentley Club, on Tuesday, March the 12th at 1 p.m. Gee, I told you I couldn't read my own writing. The luncheon will be follow our annual general meeting where you can elect a new committee if you don't like the way we do things. Sounds like you ought to get a new broadcast officer too. Nomination for committee position should be in the hands of our Secretary Arthur Evans, VK3VQ, not later than February the 28th. At the luncheon, our guest speaker will be Mr. Jim Karinakis, the Senior Technical Officer of the Australian Communications Authority's Laboratory here in Melbourne. He'll be speaking to us about the new EMR standard, which will affect us all and come into force in a few months' time. There'll be plenty of time for questions. Non-members are invited, but bookings must be made by Friday the 1st of March with Arthur Evans, VK3VQ, who is the QTHO in any call book. A good opportunity to learn something that's going to affect us all. And if you are a member of the RAAF Wireless Reserve, Col Harvey, VK1AU, would like your help. In his research about the history of the reserve, he's been unable to find two documents. They are the Wireless Reserve Training Manual and Standing Orders for the Wireless Reserve. If you have a copy of either or both of these documents, please get in touch with Col Harvey, VK1AU, who is QTHO in any call book. Sid O'Neill, VK6MK, has provided this next item about a post-war experience that changed his habits as far as drinking tea was concerned. He says, it all started on Labuan Island, just off the coast of Borneo in 1951. I was a member of the small RAF, oblique RAAF, 28 pod detachment stationed there to provide signals facilities for transiting aircraft, both service and civilian. The tea and the mess used to be served up in big aluminium kettles with milk, that's wheat shifts, brand similar to our carnation but much yellower in colour, already added. One particular evening there was considerable grumbling about the taste of the tea, even by the RAF personnel. We RAAF found it very off and declined to partake and dismissed it as one of those things. The next morning at breakfast, however, the tea was definitely undrinkable. By all. So with a bit of urging, I trotted down to the RAF CO's bungalow, mug of tea in hand, and knocked on his door. But he bade me enter and state my business. I told him the tea was off and would he care to sample it. He was sitting up in bed with his china teapot on the bedside table and declined my offer, but said there was nothing wrong with his tea, to which I replied, no, there wouldn't be. He did, however, agree to investigate. The subsequent investigation revealed that our mess boys, who were responsible for lighting the fire under the big copper kettle of those used for boiling the washing in days gone by, fitted with a tap, had decided in the interest of efficiency to eliminate the mixing of the tea and milk and the oven in the kettle. Instead, they chose to streamline the operation by adding the tea and milk to the boiling copper, then just decant the tea as required into the kettles. Just the awful tea that night. However, not content with their efficiency thus far, they left the remainder of the tea in the copper overnight, relit the fire under it the next morning, reboiled the lot, and then again decanted it into the kettles for breakfast. Imagine for a moment the smell and taste of the mixture after standing overnight in the tropics. It gave a whole new meaning to the term stewed tea. And my reward for bringing to light these cost labour-saving devices, I was appointed to the messing committee for the remainder of my tour, and I have never taken milk in my tea since that time, and we don't blame you. That was VK6MK. This is VK3OTN for the Radio Amateur Alzheimer's Club. John Harris, VK5ASL, has provided the next item. It's about the coastal radio station VIY, which operated from Mount Gambier from 1913 to 1920. On the 12th of December 2001, members of the Southeast Radio Group assembled at the site of the first wireless station in Mount Gambier to commemorate the 100th anniversary of Marconi's first transatlantic message and unveil a plaque which described the coastal station VIY. What now follows is an extract from the book A History of Radio in South Australia, 1897 to 1977, the author of Mr. John F. Ross, who has very kindly given his permission to use the story in this broadcast today and in our magazine OTN. Apart from this special permission, the story is copyright. And this is the story, and this is VK3OTN. In 1912, the federal government purchased land in Mount Gambier to erect the second coastal radio station in South Australia. The land was purchased by Mr. A.J. Kilsby at the cost of £140 and was situated off what is now known as Wireless Road, about 2 kilometres north of the city. The buildings comprised double stone structures with two main rooms, one for the radio equipment office and the other the power plant. It was erected by the Works and Railways Department and located on the summit of the hill just east of the mast. The radio facilities provided that the station were of the Bell Silly design and were installed by government staff. The total cost to establish the station was £2,438 and was commissioned for public business on the 1st of March 1913 without any formal opening ceremony. The installation was superintended by Mr. F.J. Burgoyne, who had earlier completed the Adelaide station. A few days before the completion of the work, Mr. Burgoyne and his assistant, Mr. Harry Coffey, were involved in an accident when fuel caught alight while they were making an adjustment to the engine set. The first officer in charge after commissioning the station was Mr. Coffey, who was assisted by Mr. George Bailey and Mr. A.S. Hart. Mr. Harpain became officer in charge and was there when the station closed down. The transmitting and receiving facilities were similar to those installed in Adelaide, but used a different antenna system and generated power on the station. The power plant comprised a 110-volt direct current 100-amp generator directly coupled to a single-cylinder internal combustion engine designed to consume either petrol or kerosene. It was rated at 15 kilowatts, that was about 20 horsepower, and was made by the Shaw Company. It had a flywheel about 1 metre in diameter. A small engine was provided to assist in the starting operations. The main engine was bolted to the same bed plate as the generator and joined by a leather coupling. It charged a bank of 45 accumulators, which provided the power for the operation of the radio equipment. To Direct operation of the equipment from the generator was practicable, but not very satisfactory, as the variations in loading under transmission conditions affected the speed of the engine, which in turn caused a change in the supply voltage. To deaden the noise made by the engine, the green baize covered doors, a double thickness of green baize covered the doors for the engine. The antenna system was an insulated umbrella type using standard phosphor bronze wires supported by a massive wooden mast some 51 meters high with a cross piece on top about 7 meters long. The mast is fabricated from laminated Oregon pine planks thoroughly creosoted for preservation purposes, with the planks being held together with steel coach bolts. Altogether, more than 2,000 bolts were used in the fabrication. The mast was 52 centimeters square at the bottom and was fitted with a solid concrete block. The base was poured as a block 2.5 meters square and 2.2 meters deep, resting on a limestone foundation. On top of the base, two walls 1.6 meters high were cast as an integral part of the base. After erection of the mast, the space between the walls surrounding the mast was filled with concrete. The mast was the tallest in the state and for many years was a well-known landmark in the Mount Gambier district. The weight of the mast was estimated to be about 18 tons and the cost of the wooden material alone was £300. Because of its weight, the task of erecting the mast was a difficult one. It was assembled on the ground in cradles of red gum sleepers, and three jury palms of varying lengths were used to raise it to the vertical position. The longest of these palms was about 24 meters high, and they were attached to the mast at right angles and held in position by steel ropes. A hand-operated winch located about 50 meters from the base on the eastern side was used for the erection. A strong steel rope was led from the top of the tallest jury pole to the winch, and eight men were required to turn the handle. And there's some more about the erection of the mast. Other items of equipment at the station included a rotary converter for providing power for the high voltage spark gap transformer, a battery of Leyden jars, an air compressor with a quenched arc, and crystal receiving equipment. One of the crystal sets was a Liz Cutler type. On July the 6th, 1914, the station was used to convey medical advice to the captain of the ship Armadale for treatment of a seaman who had fallen down the hold and suffered severe injuries. A report in the Border Watch newspaper indicated that Dr. W. Sangster received a communication through the station from the captain of the ship asking for advice as to the treatment to be given until such time as the ship could reach Melbourne. The doctor's advice was transmitted to the captain, whose ship at the time was about 320 kilometres off Mount Gambier. Shortly after the war, the staff was increased and continuous observations put into effect. In October 1914, the station was placed under guard by the local militia. The guard of 21 men and two officers was from C Company 74th Infantry, under the command of Captain Haig, who was assisted by Lieutenant Cape and Sergeant Callender. One of the soldiers was Mr. S.O. Whitehead, who was still active in Mount Gambier, in 1974. Another was a Mr. L.J. Lester, who was living in Adelaide. After the cessation of hostilities, operations began on a 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. basis with an officer in charge and two operators. The staff was gradually reduced up to a one-man station providing a service from 9 a.m. to 12 noon, and 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. Monday to Friday, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday, and nothing on Sunday. In 1919, the coast charge rates were tuppence per word for radio telegrams to or from ships licensed in Australia or New Zealand, and sections of word to or from other ships. Landline charges were a penny a word. It was originally intended to be a relay station between Melbourne Station BIM and Adelaide Station BIA during daylight hours. In practice, it did not provide any great advantage, as ships off the coast in the immediate vicinity could invariably communicate with all three stations, BIM, BIY, and BIA. Excuse me. Later improvements in technology resulting in more efficient transmitting and receiving equipment of these stations also contributed to the eventual close down of BIY. It was closed down in 1920 when the Coast Station Network throughout Australia was reorganised in an attempt to economise operating costs. It lay idle for about 3 years before it was dismantled. Mr. Peverick of Narra Court bought the whole installation except the mast. The engine was reinstalled at the Narra Court Electric Supply Company's powerhouse and used to drive one of their generators. The mast was sold to two local men and ended up in the local rabbit factory for case making. It was dismantled early in May 1923. The solid concrete base had to be blasted before the mast could be let down. The dismantling was carried out by Walker Brothers, who used a steam-driven traction engine to steady the pole during the lowering operations. When the mast fell, it landed across a fence post and the great mass pushed the post into the ground out of sight. A section of the mast has been preserved in the Adelaide Telecommunications Museum. The original building is now occupied as a private residence. This story was reproduced from the History of Radio in South Australia, 1897 to 1977, by Mr. John Ross, and who holds the copyright, and we acknowledge with thanks Mr. Ross's permission to use the story today. I hope you found it of interest, and thanks to John VK5ASL for finding it for us. This is VK3OTN for the Radio Amateur Old Timers Club. Next item is a wartime reminiscence for a signals unit with acknowledgement to Sir Tacito, the Journal of the Victorian Branch of the Royal Australian Signals Association, November 2001. The writer is Don Jackson, who served with No. 6 Heavy Wireless 3rd Corps Signals, and he writes, the title of his story is The Battle of Aspro. It was in 1942, if my memory serves me, that it was decided to locate land headquarters to direct operations during the anticipated invasion of West Australia. The powers that be chose a secluded island north of Perth, which was eventually codenamed Aspro. How apt this name turned out to be. Of course, wireless communications had to be assured, and with this in mind, a detachment was sent from 6 Heavy Wireless to ascertain whether communications could be maintained. Corporal Snowy was OC and there were three other WT operators. We were issued with the famous and some said infamous 109 set. The tent was pitched, aerial connected and test messages sent. We worked on a roster of 4-hour shifts. Communications were satisfactory when Snowy came on duty at 2400 hours. We had been on ops with Snowy several times and become quite used to seeing him with a blanket over his head and the phones over that. There we were, Snowy on the set, dimly lit by a low wattage bulb, and the rest of us bedded down for the night. About 0400 hours I awoke and felt rain on my face, or was I dreaming? I hurriedly aroused the others. The tent was an untidy heap 100 yards down the hill, rain pouring down, and Snowy sitting at the 109, blanket over his head, phones on, fast asleep. How's comms, Snowy? Oh, a bit of a dill at the other end, but otherwise not bad. On later ops, Snowy became notorious for dropping off. Subsequently, this area became the site for land headquarters and signals headquarters. The next time we saw it, we were most impressed. The engineers had done a wonderful job. Literally hollowed out the entire hill and divided the interior into rooms and passages, and over the lot was a huge camouflage net. It was truly amazing. We were allocated in the area beneath the net and it was proposed our van was to be placed just so, but it had to be dug in. Armed with spades, shovels, pickaxes, crowbar, etc., we attacked the designated area, only to find that just under the soil was solid rock. We worked day after day to make headway through that rock, but hardly made an impression. We mere Sigs thought it was ridiculous, but our dear sergeant in charge said we had to obey orders from above. Every night we retired exhausted and frustrated. We were self-catered, i.e. bully beef and powdered egg, and some potatoes which we found in a nearby paddock. We took turns to be cook. My turn came round all too quickly. I put the bully beef into a Dixie, poured off the fat and grease, and covered the meat with mashed potatoes and mushrooms. That was another paddock. I was unanimously voted cook for the duration and certainly beat the bully beef and powdered egg. On retiring for the night, we took turns to read out loud our one and only book, 2 pages a night to stretch it out. One by one, we would drop off, listening to the adventures of Tom and Leonora. Believe me, some of the things that pair got up to would make your hair curl. Naturally, much ad-libbing went on. When it was at last realized we had no hope of burying our man, the engineers that did the job with jellyknife. Now that was from Sir Tacito, William 8, number 9, magazine of the Royal Australian Signals Association, Victoria. Thank you for that. This is VK3ATN for the Radio Amateur Old Timers Club. Back in March 2000, Ross Croucher became 3ARC, told the story of a Lockheed Hudson bomber which became bombed in Arnhem Land. Ross now knows the subsequent history of this plane and shares it with us as follows. Since this article, among other things, was about the recovery of a Lockheed Hudson aircraft which had become bogged in a clay pan in Arnhem Land in 1943, was published in RAOTC magazine in March 2000, I've received letters from folk who were involved in the matters that I wrote about and who were interested in particular aspects of the article. One such correspondent was Mr. David Vincent, who is interested in Lockheed Hudson aircraft. He's already written and published one volume of the Hudson story, and another one was nearly ready for publication. He's obtained a great deal of information from Man magazine, and my story too was useful in filling on a few gaps. He was able to tell me the serial number of the Hudson, which was bombed in the clay pan, was A16-219. Further to that, he enclosed a copy of its complete service history from the date it was received from USA on the 17th of 4th, 42, in number 1 aircraft, AD, whatever that term is, not quite sure. It was allotted to number 13 squadron and number 2 squadron on the 22nd of the 9th, 43, and the record showed the entry as Bogged Vicinity Millengimby. This was what intrigued Mr. Vincent, and when my story appeared, it filled in the gap for him. On the 3rd of the 6:44, it was fitted out for air ambulance. On the 19th of the 10th, 45, was allocated to a photo survey unit and seems to finish the war in that capacity. It was then stored. On the 1st of the 7th, 47, it was transferred for disposal. It was eventually sold for £1,000, but this sale was cancelled. On the 13th of the 1st, 48, it was sold for £400. It became VHBLA and was used in New Guinea, but returned to Australia in 1950 and once again fitted out for survey work as VHAGG and continued in this service until 1958. Then, as Mr. Vincent puts it, whilst back in New Guinea for a short time, it stalled into the sea while on a final approach to lay, with the starboard aircrew feathered and all aboard being killed. After 16 years, what a tragedy. Thanks, Ross. David Vincent did provide a photograph of the bog plane, and we'll publish that in the for this final page of this history in our ATN magazine. This is VK3AND and Associated Relay Stations as VK3OTN. A brief note, if you're interested in satellites and you're around Melbourne, Moravan Club, on their meeting on the 22nd of the month, will have as guest speaker Mr. Robin Hayton, VE3FRN, the president of AMSAT North America. People interested would be welcome at the club, but they'd like to know you're coming because they expect a big crowd. Okay, and there's some news about one of our members. Ken Matchett, BK3TL, is the mastermind responsible for the federal WIA's astonishing collection of more than 200,000 QSL cards, their cataloguing and storage. Cards keep coming to him to sort and file, and though he now has some helpers, he still needs some more assistance, in particular with the Australian part of the collection. He'd very much appreciate a visit or a call from a Melbourne-based amateur who would consider helping. Kenneth QTHR in any call book, and his phone number is 972-85350. Repeat, 972-85350. Considering the great job he does with the QSL collection, it's a wonderful thing that at the age of 80 he's still as active and successful in his other hobby of marathon running and associated sports, in which he's competed in other countries as well as Australia. The next stop being Tahiti in a couple of weeks' time. He might even be there right now. Just 2 or 3 weeks ago, the Oceania Veterans Athletics Championship was held in Geelong with 5,000 competitors taking part. Ken came home with that event having won gold in both the 5,000-metre walk and the 5,000-metre run, plus gold in the 21-kilometre half marathon and also the 2,000-metre steeplechase. Repeat, 2,000-metre steeplechase. Not content with this, having set new records in the steeplechase and the half marathon, the steeplechase and the 5,000 metres, he went on to take silver in the 100 metre and 800 metre sprints. All that in the space of a few days in January. Beat that and play fair if you can. Congratulations, Ken. And speaking of satellites, which I did a little while ago, it reminds me of the story about the arrival of the first crew of astronauts to land on Mars. They were surprised and pleased to find that there were people there not unlike themselves, who had a language not unlike their own, so they could communicate very well. One of the astronauts, we don't know his name, became very friendly with a very attractive Martian woman, and they spent many times together discussing a very wide range of subjects. Eventually, the subject of reproduction came up. The woman said that on Mars they spat in a jar, a large jar, to which were added a series of chemicals and liquids, which were vigorously stirred and vibrated for a short time, after which the baby was formed. The astronaut expressed interest and amazement. He then described the Earthling's approach to the same problem and offered to demonstrate if she was interested. The offer was accepted, so he proceeded to demonstrate. In fact, he repeated the demonstration quite a few times. The woman said she found it very interesting and was the most enjoyable thing she'd ever done, but wanted to know where was the baby. The astronaut said, told her that that would appear in 9 months. Oh, she said, 9 months, eh? Why did you stop? And on a happy note, I'll leave it for our next broadcast in March the 4th. This is Alan Doble, VK3AMD, and associated relay stations is VK3OTN. The official call sign, the radio amateur on Timeless Club in Australia. We now conclude our transmission for this month, and we hope you found it interesting.
You have been listening to VK3OTN. VK3OTN is the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club, Australia. This concludes this month's news and information bulletin. The next RAOTC news and information broadcast will take place on the first Monday of next month, on the same frequencies, and at the same times as today, with the exception of January. Thanks for being with us, and we hope you will join in the callbacks, where callbacks are taken. 73 everyone.